Chapter 112. He gets plainer as he gets on, but not an atom more emphatic or animated. There is another point of view, he continues, in which the case presents itself. Sir Leicester is devoted to you almost to infatuation. He might not be able to overcome that infatuation, even knowing what we know. I am putting an extreme case, but it might be so. If so, it were better that he knew nothing. Better for common sense, better for him, better for me. I must take all this into account, and it combines to render a decision very difficult. She stands looking out at the same stars without a word. They are beginning to pale, and she looks as if their coldness froze her. My experience teaches me, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, who has by this time got his hands in his pockets, and is going on in his business consideration of the matter like a machine. My experience teaches me, Lady Dedlock, that most of the people I know would do far better to leave marriage alone. It is at the bottom of 3/4 of their troubles. So I thought when Sir Leicester married, and so I always have thought since. No more about that. I must now be guided by circumstances. In the meanwhile I must beg you to keep your own counsel, and I will keep mine. I am to drag my present life on, holding its pains at your pleasure, day by day, she asks, still looking at the distant sky. Yes, I am afraid so, Lady Dedlock. It is necessary, you think, that I should be so tied to the stake? I am sure that what I recommend is necessary. I am to remain on this gaudy platform on which my miserable deception has been so long acted, and it is to fall beneath me when you give the signal, she said slowly. Not without notice, Lady Dedlock. I shall take no step without forewarning you. She asks all her questions, as if she were repeating them from memory, or calling them over in her sleep. We are to meet as usual? Precisely as usual, if you please. And I am to hide my guilt, as I have done so many years? As you have done so many years. I should not have made that reference myself, Lady Dedlock, but I may now remind you that your secret can be no heavier to you than it was, and is no worse, and no better than it was. I know it certainly, but I believe we have never wholly trusted each other. She stands absorbed in the same frozen way for some little time before asking, is there anything more to be solved tonight? Why, Mr. Tulkinghorn returns methodically as he softly rubs his hands, I should like to be assured of your acquiescence in my arrangements, Lady Dedlock. You may be assured of it. Good. And I would wish in conclusion to remind you, as a business precaution, in case it should be necessary to recall the fact in any communication with Sir Leicester, that throughout our interview I have expressly stated my sole consideration, to be Sir Leicester's feelings and honor and the family reputation. I should have been happy to have made Lady Dedlock a prominent consideration too, if the case had admitted of it. But unfortunately it does not. I can attest your fidelity, sir. Both before and after saving it she remains absorbed, but at length moves, and turns, unshaken in her natural and acquired presence, towards the door. Mr. Tulkinghorn opens both the doors exactly as he would have done yesterday, or as he would have done 10 years ago, and makes his old-fashioned bow as she passes out. It is not an ordinary look that he receives from the handsome face as it goes into the darkness, and it is not an ordinary movement, though a very slight one, that acknowledges his courtesy. But as he reflects when he is left alone, the woman has been putting no common constraint upon herself. He would know it all the better if he saw the woman pacing her own rooms with her hair wildly thrown from her flung back face, her hands clasped behind her head, her figure twisted, as if by pain. He would think, so all the more, if he saw the woman thus hurrying up and down for hours, without fatigue, without intermission, followed by the faithful step upon the ghost's walk. But he shuts out the now chilled air, draws the window curtain, goes to bed, and falls asleep. And truly when the stars go out, and the wan day peeps into the turret chamber, finding him at his oldest, he looks as if the digger and the spade were both commissioned, and would soon be digging. The same wan day peeps in at Sir Leicester pardoning the repentant country in a majestically condescending dream, and at the cousins entering on various public employments, principally receipt of salary, and at the chaste Volumnia, bestowing a dower of £50,000 upon a hideous old general with a mouth of false teeth like a pianoforte full of keys, long the admiration of Bath and the terror of every other community. Also in two rooms high in the roof, and in two offices in courtyards, and over stables, where humbler ambition dreams of bliss, in keepers' lodges, and in holy matrimony with Will or Sally. Up comes the bright sun, drawing everything up with it, the wills and sallies, the latent vapor in the earth, the drooping leaves and flowers, the birds and beasts and creeping things, the gardeners to sweep the dewy turf, and unfold emerald velvet where the roller passes, the smoke of the great kitchen fire wreathing itself straight and high into the lightsome air. Lastly, up comes the flag over Mr. Tulkinghorn's unconscious head cheerfully proclaiming that Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock are in their happy home, and that there is hospitality at the place in Lincolnshire. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.